I'd like to give you a little introduction to what you're about to hear today. We started working on the Requiem at the beginning of February, adding 30 minutes to our weekly rehearsal, plus we did a Saturday rehearsal early in March because it was clear that 30 minutes was not cutting it. Initially, we were daunted by the language of the first movement because it is an odd mashup of Old English, Scottish, and Latin. And it goes really fast. We could barely wrap our tongues around the strange words at a very slow tempo and couldn't imagine we'd ever be ready to take it at the speed indicated. Some of us were wondering what we'd gotten ourselves into. I'm looking at you, Nick. But then something wonderful happened. In April, Cliff Harden, the composer, started having rehearsals every week at the River Road UU. About 15 of us made most of those rehearsals. His group has done the Requiem two or three times, so they already know it quite well. A couple of them are here today. A few of them are here today with us. As helpful as it was to be surrounded by singers who knew their parts, that wasn't the best part. For me, anyway. Spending that much time with a piece of music, good music that is, does something to you. It gets inside of you and becomes a part of you. Little by little, we fell in love with it and it got into our souls, and I know I have been changed by it. Finally, I would like to acknowledge the great privilege of learning this amazing work under the influence, under the direction of Cliff Harden himself. Anytime you get to work with a composer, it's totally next level. They work to get you to perform it the way they hear it in their head. It's kind of magical. In our performance today, I'm trying to honor Cliff's way of doing things as much as we can. So now, without further ado, we bring you the result of 4 months of concerted effort and a beautiful, meaningful, wonderful piece of music. We hope you enjoy it. Please hold your applause until the end of the final movement.
Princess Pelotis and Poetess Hatties. The first movement of our UU Requiem is a stark reminder that, spoiler alert, none of us are getting out of this alive, right? In the end, death is coming for us all, as those powerful lyrics remind us. Since this Requiem is written out, you know, written by a UU composer out of Unitarian Universalist values, it may help to recall some of the ways that death has showed up for some of our most well-known UU forebears. How they coped with grief, how they worked their way to integrate and live with deep losses. We UUs have a habit of making these really long lists of all the famous folks, you know, paradigm-shifting people who have been Unitarians and Universalists, and we tend to claim them. If they even attended one service, we're like, yep, claiming them. And sometimes we tend to highlight their great achievements of our ancestors without also recalling some of the moments when they, like all of us humans, were brought low. In the first two parts of this sermon, I want to invite us to focus on Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, drawing from a book titled Three Roads Back: How Emerson, Thoreau, and William James Responded to the Greatest Losses in Their Lives. It's by Robert Richardson, who's written major biographies of all three figures. Then in the final two parts of the sermon, I want to shift our focus to what are some practices today that we can use to find our way through grief and death and loss. Let's begin with Emerson, one of our most famous Unitarian forebears. He was an essayist, an abolitionist, and a leader in the 19th century Transcendentalist movement. For a time, he was also a Unitarian minister before he decided that the lecture circuit was a better fit for his gifts and his temperament. For a time, an underappreciated part of his change in vocation is that a tragic loss was a significant part of what motivated him to change his life. A few years before Emerson started to become famous, come with me back to 1831. Emerson and his wife, Ellen, were deeply in love. They had been married just a little more than a year. And Ellen contracted tuberculosis. It led to her death at the tragically young age of 19. Emerson was completely devastated. In his journals, he describes himself as unstrung, as debilitated by grief. He began walking almost 5 miles every day from his house to visit her grave, and there are many examples of him continuing to write to Ellen in his journals as if she were still alive. Although Emerson carried on his professional duties, his intellectual pursuits as best he could, the depth of his grief persisted. And 14 months after his wife's death, and this also isn't talked about that often, we read a journal entry in which he wrote only one short sentence. It said, "I visited Ellen's tomb, and I opened the coffin." This is 14 months later. We don't know precisely why Emerson felt compelled to view his wife's body more than a year after her death, but we can speculate that this unusual act was part of his personal process. It's all any of us can really do, to do our best, to stumble our way through what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross later called those five stages of grief, to find our way from grief and denial and anger and bargaining and acceptance and often spiraling back and forth through them. Many scholars also suspect that Emerson's act was connected to the same aspect of his temperament that left him dissatisfied with secondhand truths, things other people told him. It's the same temperament that would soon lead him to help co-found the Transcendentalist revolt within Unitarianism. We often call it the Transcendentalist movement. It truly was a revolt within Unitarianism of the time, which Emerson described as corpse cold. Emerson felt this deep desire to experience the world firsthand for himself. And being confronted with the truth of our human finitude, it shifted something within Emerson. And a little more than 2 months later, he preached a theologically controversial sermon at his Unitarian congregation. You may be thinking, How does one preach a theologically controversial sermon at a Unitarian congregation? Let's just say that sermon would not be considered radical today in a UU congregation. We'd probably think it passé. But in the early 19th century, the questioning of some of the core tenets of Christianity was transgressive within Unitarianism. And 7 days later, he resigned his pulpit, and that catalyzed his shift toward becoming a public intellectual. We'll never know how different Emerson's life might have been if his wife hadn't died. But it's possible that he would have remained a fairly conventional Unitarian minister a lot longer than he did. Confronting death and grief and loss, it's rarely something any of us would choose. But being forced to face our mortality is also an invitation to re-examine our life and consider what really matters given our limited time here. At such times, our invitation is also to offer one another whatever comfort we can. As the lyrics to our next song say, even during the hardest times, we can still reach out to one another and say, give me your hand.
Give me your hand by these gray waters. The day is ending. Already the first faint star pierces the veil of heaven. In the joy together to these gray shores and quiet waters, and the day's ending, the day is ending. The journey is ended.
I am not free.
I am not free.
I am not free.
I am not free.
they go, the intelligent, the witty, the brave. I know, but I do not approve. I know, but I do not approve.
Let's turn to Henry David Thoreau, another of our transcendentalist forebears and Emerson's protege. Thoreau is most well known for his book, Walden, and for his essay, Civil Disobedience, both very much worth reading or rereading if you haven't looked at them in a while. As with Emerson, if you only know Thoreau's writing, you miss some of the most significant details of his life. Like all of us humans, he sometimes found himself face to face with grief and death and loss. So come with me then to New Year's Day, 1842. It's about a decade after the death of Emerson's first wife, Ellen. That fateful January of 1842, Thoreau's oldest brother, John, cut his finger while shaving. Just a week later, the wound grew gangrenous and lockjaw set in. And on January 11th, John died in Henry's arms at the far too young an age of 27. Less than 2 weeks later, further tragedy struck. Emerson had remarried, and his five-year-old son, Waldo, contracted scarlet fever. As with the tetanus that killed Thoreau's brother, no vaccination or treatment for scarlet fever was available at the time. And Waldo died a few days later, again at the age of 5. Some of you will know the name Louisa May Alcott as the author of Little Women. Her father, Bronson, was friends with Emerson. He was one of the transcendentalists. Louisa May Alcott was 9 years old at the time. They lived nearby. And when she knocked on the door, because she had heard Waldo was sick, so she knocked on the door to see how he was doing. Emerson answered. He was so overcome with sadness that all he could say to her was, "Child, he is dead." Alcott later wrote that this was her first encounter with deep grief. Emerson recorded in his journal, "I comprehend nothing of the fact of Waldo's death but its bitterness. Explanation I have none, consolation none. None that arises out of the fact itself. There's only diversion, only oblivion of this and pursuit of new objects. Thoreau was likewise laid flat between the two deaths, his brother and Waldo, who he loved. He was unable to get out of bed for 4 long weeks. He wrote, "I feel like a feather floating in the atmosphere, and on every side is depth unimaginable." Thoreau eventually began to process, to integrate, and learn to live with these losses, not to get over them, but to learn to live with them through his connection to nature, his close study of how death and decay was so present in the plant and animal world, in nature. It helped him cultivate this growing appreciation that death, for better, for worse, it's just a part of all living things. And we humans are merely this minuscule part of this huge, tremendously enormous ecological whole. Emerson likewise came to find some solace in seeing himself, both his achievements and his losses, as only this tiny part in the grand scheme of things. He wrote, "The lesson of life is practically to generalize, to believe what the years and the centuries say against the hours, to resist the usurpation of the particulars, to penetrate to their universal sense. General ends are somehow answered." In the words of Emerson's biographer, there's a whole lot of resilience hidden in that word, somehow. General ends are somehow answered. So much remains beyond our human capacity to fully comprehend, especially in advance. As we've seen in the lives of both Emerson and Thoreau, the next two movements of our Requiem are reminders that difficult times are coming for us all. And ultimately, it's up to each one of us, both individually and together, to find our unique way through and to help each other as best we can.
Lovers and thinkers, into the earth with you. Be one with the dull, the indiscriminate dust, a fragment of what you felt, of what you knew, a formula, a phrase remains, but the best is lost. The answers quick and keen, the honest look, the laughter, the love, they are gone. They are gone to feed the roses. Elegant and curled is the blossom. Fragrant is the blossom. I know, but I do not approve. More precious was the light in your eyes than all the roses in the world.
Thank you.
Our reflections on grief and loss, even among our most famous UU forebears, are a reminder that none of us are exempt. None of us are exempt. Death is an integral part of the human condition. And there's a mantra in the Buddhist tradition that challenges us to ask a powerful related question. It's an inquiry practice. You assume your meditation posture and then, you know, drop this question into your consciousness, kind of like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? But this one is, since death alone is certain and the time of death uncertain, what shall I do? And just drop that into your consciousness with real curiosity, not knowing the answer. You know, ask it like you lost your keys. Where are my keys? Like, you really don't know where your keys are. Ask that question. Since death alone is certain and the time of death uncertain, what shall I do? In the final two sections of this sermon, I want to turn our focus to potential responses to that question. Earlier, I mentioned Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's famous five stages of grief. Importantly, she never said that these stages are exactly what all people go through in this precise order, which is just what a lot of people who have never read Elizabeth Kubler-Ross think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said. She's been frequently misinterpreted that way. Instead, she's simply describing the common experiences of grief for many people, and especially that she saw among her many clients. I'd also like to share with you some of the interesting work being done by her protege, David Kessler, who's written many books, but in particular, he's seeking to carry her legacy forward with a book titled Finding Meaning, the Sixth Stage of Grief, one more after Kubler-Ross's five. And prior to her death in 2004, she officially gave her blessing to Kessler's conviction that a sixth stage was needed. For those of us still here on the other side of death and loss, finding meaning can sometimes look like gratitude. Just being thankful, even though they're gone, just being thankful for the days and the years that you were able to spend with your loved one. Telling stories about our lost loved ones is perhaps the most powerful way to keep their memory alive in our minds and our hearts and our spirits. Finding meaning can also look like extending the legacy of those who have died. Kessler suggests asking these three questions whenever you find yourself, you know, maybe I'm ready to move to the meaning stage. You might ask yourself, how can I honor my loved one? How can I honor my loved one? Or how can I create a different life that still includes them or a memory of them? Or how can I use my experience, what happened to me, how can that help others? Because often no one is more helpful to people in grief than someone who's experienced something quite similar to them, like in a support group. One famous example of what Kessler's talking about is Candy Leitner. Some of you will know that name. In 1980, her daughter Carrie was killed by a drunk driver. And although she continued to mourn the loss of her daughter for the rest of her life, she also found deep meaning in founding MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which has been a powerful force in this country and has saved just a tremendous number of lives that might otherwise have died. In our own time, we're seeing similar movements of seeking meaning in the wake of deep grief and loss through groups like Every Town for Gun Safety, you know, organizing to prevent gun violence. There's still a long way for that movement to go, but it's people trying to say enough and we need a change. The Buddhist tradition teaches that there's often little we can do to prevent the ways that Buddhism loves to make lists. There's often little we can do to prevent the eight worldly winds that just capriciously blow into our lives. Praise and then blame. Success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, they just blow, often unpredictably. They come unexpectedly for each of us. What we are much more able to influence is our response to what we do next, to any of those eight worldly winds. No matter what happens, we can seek to be as wise, compassionate, and generous as is possible to us in any given moment. Sometimes we still give in to hate and greed and delusion, right? But we seek, as much as possible, to be as wise and as generous and as compassionate as we can be. And a tremendous help for that process is the support of our family and our friends and our communities. And I want to say just a few more words about that, but as I do so, I want to invite our ushers to go ahead and come forward for the offering in a few moments. And when I'm done speaking, they're going to wait to pass the baskets until after Jeff's through, and they'll pass them as the choir sings the next song. How many of you have been to at least one Unitarian Universalist celebration of life for someone who has died? So we typically call it a celebration of life, not a funeral or memorial service. So many times after a memorial service, a friend or a family member who had never been to a UU congregation before, they will come up to me and say, "I just want you to know, that's the single most meaningful memorial service I've ever been to in my entire life." And the reason for that typically, and this, if I get in trouble for this, it is what it is. It's because a lot of religious traditions, the focus of the memorial service is on ancient religious dogma. It's not about the person. And making us truly a celebration of a person's life, I think that's why people come up to us and say, "Wow, you know, I'm just glad that was about this person and not X religious figure who, you know, died 2 millennia ago." So, and one of the most important roles that spiritual communities play in our lives is rites of passage. For those of you here a few weeks ago, that beautiful blessing we did with those lovely children that were here, the coming of age service we did for Davin a few weeks ago, the weddings, celebration of life, etc. All the parts of your journey in between, all your griefs, all your joys, all your losses, all your sorrows, all your celebrations as well. One of my late colleagues, the Reverend Forrest Church, he used to say, what religion actually is, the reason we have religion is our human response to two truths, being alive and having to die. That's why we have religion, because we're alive and we have to die. So to support this community, which helps hold us, and support us and guide us through whatever comes our way, the offering will be gratefully received.
The first day's night had come, and grateful that a thing so terrible had been endured, I told my heart to sing. She said her strings were snapped, her bow to atoms blown, and so to mend her, gave me work until another morn. And then a day as used yesterday in pairs unrolled its horror on my face until it blocked my eyes.
to help with navigating the sixth stage of grief, meaning. David Kessler suggests the following reframings that can help shift our perceptions of ourselves and our experience. And as I name, there's just about four of them. Just notice if there's a shift within yourself as I name these. Notice the difference between saying, "This death happened to me." You're very, very personal. "This death happened to me," versus "death happens." Death happens. Just noticing that, kind of shifting from first person to third person. Or how about this? "I'm a victim of this." You know, very personalized and very objective, you know, kind of very static and a one-to-one correlation. "I'm a victim" versus something more active or changing. "I survived" or "I am surviving this loss." "I'm a victim" versus "I'm surviving this loss. I'm learning to live with it." Or how about this? "Why did this happen to me?" versus "Bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. Bad things happen to everyone. It's just part of the human condition." Why me? Versus "bad things happen." And finally, what about "my story is the saddest one"? "My story is the saddest one too. My story has some very sad parts." "My story is the saddest one too. My story has some very sad parts, but other things are true." Do you know that Brené Brown line? "The story I'm telling about myself, the story I'm telling myself about this is ... right? And that's good, but then it's like, is that story still serving me? Is that the only story I could tell? Might I tell some other stories about this, and might there also be truth in that? Let me elaborate just briefly on one of those in particular. That "why me" piece, it's super, super common. It's just very natural, very human to ask when bad things happen. Why me? But I want us to also remember and invite us to ask a very powerful question: why not me? Why not me? And also to flip that on when good stuff happens to us: why me? And why not someone else, right? You can kind of flip this all around. To say just a little more about that, can you picture in your head the yin-yang symbol, you know, the swirling, like a little white swirl with a black dot and a black swirl with a white dot, and they're spinning around and meant to kind of indicate change. So it's a symbol from the Taoist tradition, and some of you will know this story, but I want to remind you of an ancient Taoist story that is kind of the narrative version of that yin-yang symbol. It goes like this. Father and his son were living, you know, out on kind of ancient tribal lands in Asia. And they lost their horse. The horse just wandered away. And all of the village came to the father and the son, and they said, "We're so sorry that you lost your horse." And the father said to them, "I don't know. Is that good news or is it bad news? I don't know." And a few months passed, and that horse came back and brought with it five other horses. And all the village rushed over to the father and said, "We're so happy for you. Your horse has returned, and it's brought five other horses." And he said, "Is that good news or is it bad news? I'm not sure." And then riding on one of those new horses, his son fell off and broke his leg. And all of the village came over, and they said, "We're so sorry your son broke his leg." And he said, "I don't know. Is that good news or is that bad news? I'm not sure." And then a few weeks later, a neighboring tribe whose horses those were came, and all of the able-bodied young men were killed fighting that neighboring tribesman. And because that son had broken his leg, he survived. And again, the father said, "You know, is this good news? Is this bad news?" Like, just seeing the way, and that's the yin-yang symbol. That's the Taoist truth. Good luck changes into bad luck, and bad luck changes into good, and it cannot be known in advance where their alternating ends. So all we can do is, how do we respond to whatever happens in any given present moment? And how we respond to death and loss, it is often a long and messy and deeply personal process. And each one of you, don't let anyone ever tell you otherwise, each one of you is ultimately the expert in your grief. And we can only stumble our way through these stages of grief. And similar to that Taoist tale of good and bad being mixed up in everything, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, most people only know her for her 5 stages of grief. But I think this quote is also incredibly, incredibly important. She used to say, death is 2 things. It is both one of the most catastrophic and destructive forces that we will ever encounter. And it is also can be one of the most constructive and positive and creative elements in culture and life. Multiple things can be true, destructive and constructive, opening up new things. As with so many things, multiple things can be true at the same time, depending on your perspective. And our perspective shifts over time, even if we can't perceive in advance, and often we can't perceive in advance how it will shift. We're all just doing our best to find our way through this world, but an additional truth is that we don't have to do it alone. I'm grateful to be on this journey with all of you.
Into which our grief has given us entrance, and inevitably we feel about us their arms, their sympathy, their understanding.
Sorry, right, was violent into infinite.
Will not freeze love, time flow.
which generates
Oh, Amazing. Thank you all so much for your hard work. Three very quick final things. I know we're running long, but this is important. Death, it's important. First, a public service announcement. Who here has a will, living will, and power of attorney? All three of those things. That's good. I've had one since I was 23, because already by then, having been through seminary, you know, I'd already seen too much. And I was like, you know, I really do believe everyone, if you're over 18, you need a will, you need a living will, and you need a power of attorney. If you don't have one, make plans to get one next week. Also, do your loved ones know where those are if you were to die unexpectedly? You know, that's a corollary to that. Google 5 wishes later if you need to. 5 wishes, and that'll walk you through doing some of this stuff. 5 wishes. There's other resources. Second, one final thing on death, and then I want to talk about the afterlife very briefly. Or lack thereof. I don't know. We'll talk about it. One final thing on... So 5 wishes. The second kind of assignment I'd give you is sometime later today or this afternoon, many of you have probably done this before, but reread Mary Oliver's poem, A Summer Day. That's the one that ends with the most famous thing she ever wrote, right? Tell me what it is you plan to do with your one wild and precious life, right? Everyone knows that line. The whole poem, though, is worth reading. But even more importantly, it's so interesting to me and poignant that everyone quotes the final two lines, tell me what it is you plan to do with your one wild and precious life, and not the line right before, which is, doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? So tell me what it is you plan to do with your one wild and precious life. They're so connected. Talking about death can really be sharpening. It doesn't have to just be depressing. It can be depressing, but it can also be sharpening. You know, what do you want to do with your one wild and precious life? And finally, on what does or doesn't happen after we die, and a third assignment I would give you. So 5 wishes, Summer Day by Mary Oliver. And finally, who's watched the Netflix series Surviving Death? Surviving Death. Any hands out? Okay, I see just a few hands. It's worth watching. So I'll tie this back into what I was saying earlier about Emerson preaching a theologically controversial sermon. This might be something theologically controversial in a UU congregation today, this series, Surviving Death. It's headed up by a New York Times reporter, which is part of what, there's a lot of, in my judgment, hokey things about the potential afterlife. This, I think, is more, trying to be more rigorous. So Leslie Keene, really interesting New York Times reporter. And what it picks up on is a number of things, including, is there a way, and maybe something to reincarnation understood from a 21st century perspective? You know, really trying to say, what can we investigate with science? And it's drawing from the really interesting work that's been being done for decades at the University of Virginia Medical School in the Division of Perceptual Studies. This is the University of Virginia Medical School, right? They've been doing this stuff for decades, investigating, is there anything to this reincarnation and past lives? So check it out, Netflix, Surviving Death. Let me know what you think. And so because none of us know how much time we have, all we can ultimately do in each present moment is to continue, you know, to choose to do as best we can, to choose wisdom and generosity and love. So continue your journey with love. Care for one another. Care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And as you go, whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace, or joy, or maybe just a heightened awareness of your mortality, right? That goes with us. We are different for having spent this time together. You all are different for having spent all this time around this requiem, right? You're different. May you live boldly. May you live with thanksgiving. Go in peace.